Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Frontier Space Podcast, a series about how space technology, colonization, and exploration are transforming our solar system. 60 Seconds in Space. Arizona-based startup Ho Industries designed a 2.4-kilogram satellite called Thermosat that uses a thermal condenser to boil distilled water into superheated steam for propulsion to stealthily change orbit, deorbit, and avoid collisions. And US-based researchers propose a new CubeSat with water-based propulsion that uses a system called Hydros to electrolyze hydrogen and oxygen for thrust. Very excited to hear from Dr. Andrew Rivkin, a planetary astronomer from Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. Andy is a leading asteroid researcher with over three decades of experience researching near-Earth objects and hydrated asteroids with spectroscopy, and a passion for dwarf planet Ceres. Greetings, Andy. Welcome to the Frontier Space Podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How's the sleet and freezing snow over in Maryland?
I think it's dying down today. We had definitely got a decent accumulation. I mean, not as much as, you know, not like a foot or anything, but enough that we're probably gonna have to deal with it rather than wait for it to melt.
Ah, I see. So my first question was, what really sparked your interest and drives your motivation in pioneering asteroid research for humanity?
Oh, wow. So when I was in graduate school, which is, you know, I started graduate school in the early 90s, and my advisor was a person named Larry Lebowski, who's happily still around and still doing stuff. He was the first person to really do infrared studies of ice and other water-bearing minerals using infrared wavelengths, looking at solid surfaces. So he was the one who found that the rings of Saturn were made of ice, you know, sorts of things. And he started studying asteroids. He found these hydrated minerals on Ceres and some other large asteroids. And I, as his student, naturally kind of followed in that sort of research. And as time has gone on, it's the data we've been able to take from the ground has gotten better. We've been able to get more information than simply say, yeah, there's something there, or no, there's not, and be able to actually identify specific kinds of minerals that have water in them, to differentiate ice from clays that have water in them.
Yeah, yeah. You're really helping spearhead this massive data gap in hydrated minerals and asteroids off planet. I definitely appreciate your everything you're up to and doing. I was wondering, what are the benefits of using this water in these hydrated near Earth objects and compared to places like the lunar poles?
So that's a great question. As you and your listeners probably know, it takes a lot of energy to bring material off of the surface of the Earth and out into space. It turns out that one of the limiting factors on how long you can operate things in geosynchronous orbit is basically the amount of fuel that you can bring up to those satellites, or that those satellites have on them. Once they can no longer maneuver themselves, then they have to be deorbited, or else you can't have things up there unable to move and tumbling and potentially causing a hazard to other geosynchronous satellites. So ideally, you would be able to refuel those satellites, but again, bringing fuel from the surface of Earth up there costs a lot of energy, and now you're burning fuel to bring up extra fuel. If you do the math, it is easier to bring material from a lot of near-Earth asteroids to geosynchronous Earth geosynchronous orbit, and it's much more energy efficient to do that. And that's the business case that I think a lot of these asteroid mining companies have been thinking about. The lunar poles have a similar problem to the surface of Earth in the sense that you have to move something off of the surface of a big body, but a body with a lot of gravity, at least certainly compared to the asteroids, the moon has a lot of gravity. So the case for using lunar water, at least that I've seen, tends to be limited to nearby bases, you know, maybe bases elsewhere on the moon, maybe bases very close to the lunar poles. That's why you put your base near the lunar poles in the first place. But the sort of economic case for mining in space in the nearest term involves these asteroids. You can do it. It can be useful to assets that are already in place in geosynchronous orbit. If you can fetch the material you need from the asteroids, or refine it, I suppose, after getting it from the asteroids, and then just bring it there to the satellites in geosynchronous orbit.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really eye-opening when you think of the long-term ramifications on how that'll influence the space architecture and infrastructure. The water ice in these asteroids might be more valuable as drinking potable water rather than water propulsion, but it kind of depends on the progression of the field. Water propulsion systems or directly used as in water electrolysis for oxygen and hydrogen for rocket propellant or these orbital colonies we'd all love to see one day.
There's a lot of I think there's a lot of nuance that we have yet to really figure out. In almost all cases, I think the water in asteroids is going to be this form that's kind of bound up in the minerals rather than ice. So for instance, if you pick up certain kinds of clays, if you go to the store and you buy a bag of kitty litter, the kitty litter, the minerals that are in that sort of stuff is 10% water. Even before the cat, gets a hold of it, it's just water bound up in those minerals. So a lot of the proposals for using asteroid water involve taking rocks like what was collected on Bennu, say, by OSIRIS-REx, heating them up to drive off the water and then collecting that water and using that. It's not yet clear how much processing would need to be done to that water to make it safe to drink. One of the reasons that asteroids are really scientifically interesting is that they are more or less unprocessed since they formed 4.5 billion years ago. And so a lot of elements that are not found at the Earth's surface that are down in the Earth's core are still kind of mixed in the asteroids. So you might, extract the water and find it's got a whole bunch of arsenic in it or mercury in it, or at least more arsenic and mercury than we like to typically drink. So I think that's definitely a matter of some ongoing research, and one that I know people like Alessandra Springman at the University of Arizona has written some papers about.
Fascinating. Yeah, we'll have to check that out. In your research paper that's titled "How Many Hydrated Near-Earth Objects Are There?" Which is really what sparked this conversation. You mentioned C-class or carbonaceous asteroids. What are those, and what are the asteroid spectral types?
When meteorites were first collected and brought into the laboratory, and people got their visible and near IR spectra, they found that the different main classes of meteorites also had different kinds of spectra. So the ordinary chondrite meteorites, which at the time were just called the stony meteorites, those had a particular spectrum. When asteroids were found with a similar spectrum, they were called S-type, S for stony. The M-type asteroids were named because they had spectra that were reminiscent of the iron metal meteorites, so M for metal. The carbonaceous chondrites are a pretty rare class of meteorites. They are the only ones that have hydrated minerals, or at least that commonly have hydrated minerals. They are so named because they have carbon. They are not the only ones with carbon, but they do have carbon. They're very dark. And we think that they formed a little bit further from the sun than the Earth did, and that most of these other meteorites. The C-class asteroids, and again, the same logic was used, the asteroids that had spectra that reminded us of the carbonaceous chondrite meteorites, have a relatively featureless spectrum through the visible on the near IR. Something like Eros, which is an S-class asteroid, has a spectrum that lets us say, oh, it's got this kind of olivine, it's got this kind of pyroxene. Itokawa's got a similar spectrum. Vesta, we can look at Vesta and see what its rock type is just from the visible and near IR, and again associate that with a particular meteorite type. But the carbonaceous chondrites are featureless, more or less, so that doesn't give us a lot to work with. There is, and that's why you have to look at somewhat longer wavelengths. If you've been following work that's been done by the Dawn spacecraft at Ceres, or by OSIRIS-REx at Bennu, or by Hayabusa 2 at Ryugu, a lot of the, at least to my mind, most interesting work that's been done is done at slightly longer wavelengths, where you can measure water and hydrated minerals and ice. So the specific subgroup of the C-class asteroids that I focus on in the paper, that Francesca DeMeo and I focus on this paper, are called the CH-class. Those do have a kind of a shallow absorption in the red part of the spectrum. And we know from kind of years of studies and correlations that the CH, that when you see that band in the red part of the spectrum, you know there's going to be hydrated minerals of a particular kind, like the carbonaceous chondrites. A space telescope would also work, but we were looking in this paper to try to provide the easiest way to do big picture surveys that, again, we thought that people who are interested in finding good targets for mining might find useful.
Thanks. Thanks for clarifying. I got a much better understanding now. How many C-type or hydrated asteroids do you estimate in the near-Earth object population? A lot of numbers in your paper.
Yeah, the short answer, I guess, is that we expect something like between sort of 25 to 75, larger than 1 kilometer. When we look in the main asteroid belt and we can say, okay, how many of these CH type asteroids, or what fraction of asteroids are the CH type? We go to people who have done the calculations of where near Earth objects come from in the asteroid belt. And that's actually the big, a big science question, among others that kind of we touch on here. We don't know. When we look at the main asteroid belt, we see that it's really dominated by these C-complex asteroids. These dark asteroids are most of what's in the main belt. And when we look at the NEOs, we can already see that it's not most of what's in the NEOs. Something is already cutting down those numbers.
In your paper, you estimated average water concentrations of the near-Earth object asteroids to be around 10% by mass in water.
Yeah, the those numbers are based on the meteorites that we think are most like the CH asteroids. They have something like 5 to 10% water per, you know, per mass.
Wonderful. Yeah, it sounds like there a lot of challenges in the present day in imaging these hydrated minerals from the Earth's surface.
Sure. The main problem from the Earth's surface is that we have water in the atmosphere. And of course, that's good because if we didn't have water in the atmosphere, it'd be a tough place to live. But since we are looking for water on the surfaces of these bodies, it's basically like, you know, trying to, we have to account for the water in the Earth's atmosphere and correct for it. When we try to look for the water directly and not this absorption band in the red, that takes good weather. It takes being in a good site. Right now, there are very few sites that can actually do this work. Almost all of the work is done from the top of Mauna Kea. The near-Earth asteroids pose an additional complication, which is that they are well, they're hot compared to main belt asteroids. And that heat also comes out as infrared light. And so to be able to measure the absorption band of hydrated minerals, you now not only have to deal with the Earth's atmosphere, but you have to correct for the infrared light that's coming off of these objects. Ideally, in a lot of ways, this would be done from space. The James Webb Space Telescope will allow some great measurements to be made, and actually, I'm on one of the teams that will be measuring asteroids from with the James Webb Telescope. But you know, the James Webb is is going to be in very, very high demand. Plus, it's designed to look, you know, at the far reaches of the solar system. Is designed to look at, you know, galaxies far away and stuff. So it can't track fast enough to look at a lot of near Earth objects. In principle, you know, that would be another kind of approach to build something not as capable and big and fancy as the James Webb Space Telescope, but just put something more modest, but with a dedicated mission of just looking at near Earth objects.
Yeah, it sounds like an exciting new mission you're proposing.
It's true. Well, and it's funny though, because there is also to go back somewhat, I think there is a legitimate question of, you know, there's great science to be done, but in the context of if this were to be done to help asteroid mining companies, you know, it's legit to ask, you know, who would benefit, you know, and if American taxpayers say we're being asked to pay for such a mission to make sure that, you know, the results get to benefit, you know, the American taxpayers in turn, or whichever country or humanity as a whole. So it's
Yeah, that's definitely important, and there definitely should be more incentives in society for collect this data. And you mentioned space telescopes. How much could telescopes and instrumentation on the Moon and Mars help us understand and quantify the spectra in these hydrated asteroids? And where would you want to build one?
the moon is an interesting possibility. Like I was saying, right, the Earth's atmosphere is one of the big problems, and certainly the moon would get around that problem. You know, I think a space telescope not too far from Earth would be fine. I think I'd be perfectly satisfied with that. And you know, you could get the data back to Earth relatively easily if I felt super ambitious and you know, money and communication were no object, then I might actually move it further in toward the sun, looking outward. People who have been advocating or studying NEO search telescopes for quite some time have advocated for an object in close to the orbit of Venus, not orbiting Venus, but at that kind of distance from the sun, because that way you could look outward and find basically anything that would approach the Earth. While if you're at Earth's orbit, you'd have to look both in toward the sun and away from the sun.
Ah, fascinating. So, thanks for sharing. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of synergy between some of the asteroid mining topics of interest and things like planetary defense. And for that matter, people who, you know, the idea of sending astronauts to asteroids, which was the policy, you know, in the Obama administration, and may eventually make a, you know, make a comeback. There are a lot of the questions that you want to answer to do one of those things that actually apply to most of them.
The next question was, how much more accessible is the water ice in the near Earth object asteroids compared to the lunar poles?
In order to bring material, this is an interesting question, and it's one that we kind of had to juggle a few different numbers for. The measure of accessibility is this number called delta V, which again I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with. And the lunar poles are obviously, it's much easier to get to the moon than most places, but the lunar gravity is requires enough energy to get to you know, to do the trip, that it does make lots and lots of asteroids more accessible or requiring less energy. Depending on whether you, on how big of an asteroid you want to visit, we estimated that something like between 10 and 30 of them that are larger than 1 kilometer should be more accessible than going to the surface of the moon and coming back. If you don't care about size, then it's more like, 500 to 1,000, 400 to 1,000, something like that. Another factor which may or may not be important when you're doing these things is this is strictly a matter of the energy that's required. So a matter of how much fuel you're going to bring to go and come back. It doesn't factor in time. So no matter, it may require much less energy to go to some near Earth object and come back, but it might also take you 10 times as long or 100 times as long. Kind of imagine that in this kind of future where you're mining asteroids like this, you're maybe always going to have something on the way there, something on the way back. It doesn't really matter so much how long it takes, but you know, we're not investors, we're not venture capitalists. We don't know if there's going to be some pressure to show profits right away or something like that. That's certainly something that other folks would have to think about.
Yeah, as he mentioned that most of the hydrated mass in these near-Earth objects, they're found in a few of the largest hydrated near-Earth objects with diameters from 3.2 to 1.71 kilometers. And I started thinking about it more, and you know, these large NEOs, these hydrated asteroids, I feel like they're kind of relatively easy to claim if you start thinking about it. You know, you just like send a probe and lander there or something. And
yeah, the that that kind of goes back to the ethics questions again, and the legal issues. There are various international treaties that have been passed or that have been proposed, or I guess some of both. So nations cannot claim territory in space. But nations or companies can, as I understand it, claim or can extract resources and make use of resources. It's a matter at this point of figuring out some of those details, and some countries have been trying to move the legal questions forward. The United States, Luxembourg, and the UAE, I think, have all kind of passed laws that have been relevant to asteroid mining. Among the questions are going to be if you get the first company to go to wherever it is, whether it's Bennu or 1996 FG3 or any of the other big ones that I mentioned, and start a facility there, is it going to be able to establish a monopoly and keep anyone else from doing it just because it's not going to be economically feasible to have more than one company?
Yeah,
these questions that have been, it's kind of unfortunately the sci-fi meets, meets law, and people like thinking about, Han Solo dodging through the through the asteroid field, but we're also going to need the people sitting down and figuring out, what's in bounds, what's out of bounds, and what the consequences are for breaking those laws.
Yeah, a lot of really interesting points there. And in regards to the mass estimates of the water ice, I remember you mentioning that there was more water ice estimated to be in the hydrated near Earth objects than at the lunar south poles. In the asteroid population that's 1 kilometer above, that came out to be 480 to 800 billion kilograms of water ice in the near Earth object asteroids, more accessible than the lunar south poles, which had estimates of around 200 to 740 billion kilograms of water ice. It's really mind-boggling to think about these numbers.
Yeah, these are big numbers. I wish the thrusters that people have been proposing or been actually putting on sale using water, and I think looking toward a future of using water from asteroids to propel those, those are typically, at least that I've seen, talking about maybe a kilogram or a few kilograms of fuel. So certainly that seems like that would last us a very long time. But we also seem to be pretty good as a species at using up lots of things when we're given the chances. Not that we're going to exhaust the asteroids, anytime soon. But on the other hand, I'm sure that the first Europeans to come to North America figured that there was, were plenty of trees. They never run out of trees, and never run out of bison and all that stuff. And even just thinking about the bandwidth of we're here sitting hundreds of miles apart, with a video quality and an audio quality that's as good as the television that I had, growing up, sort of thing. And I think as our appetite for the kinds of things delivered from space, the reason that we'd expand our geosynchronous satellites and our communication satellite's capability would be to deliver, you know, faster and faster internet speeds to, you know, greater and greater fractions of the Earth's surface. And if we built, you know, more and more capable satellites to do that, you know, the demand might get pretty big. I don't have a good sense, and I wish I did have a good sense of, you know, whether that many kilograms of water is something that at current rates would last, you know, 1,000 years or 10,000 years or 50 years, or I don't know. But I think a lot of people view it as, at least a lot of the advocates for asteroid mining view this as kind of just taking the first step out, and that as, and I suppose mining, you know, as you move out into the solar system, different places become counting as accessible. So these asteroids that are accessible to Earth maybe are not going to be the most accessible ones from Mars or et cetera.
Awesome. Well, this has been really eye-opening, and thanks a lot for your time, Andy.
Sure thing. My pleasure. Thank you.
And keep up the great work with James Webb and this future space telescope one day.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
You too.